It's a lot. I know. All the stuff, it's getting you down. I can tell. The economy can tell too, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Tuesday, today, 25 August. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Hey, so what's that thing we say about consumers in this economy all the time? Anybody remember? Oh, right. Yeah. That basically the whole thing is on us. Consumers and consumer spending drive this economy, which makes it, well, troubling, honestly, to have to relate to you this morning's report on the confidence of said consumers. It's down. The confidence index was in August. That's from the Conference Board. They publish the index. It's down a fair bit from the July measurement, and it's down a whole lot from the June number when things were looking better. But the summer virus surge, states putting a hold on reopening, schools starting virtually, and gridlock in Washington are all kind of taking a toll. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman starts us off.
Economist Lynn Franco at the Conference Board says consumers are getting more pessimistic about their economic situation.
That cloud of uncertainty seems to be covering the majority of consumers. There's not much of an expectation that business conditions or employment are going to improve. And we've actually seen consumers grow a little bit more negative about their financial well-being.
Consumers are still hesitant to return to their favorite pre-pandemic places and pastimes to spend money. Joanna Piacenza at polling firm Morning Consult says that's largely due to the midsummer spike in COVID cases.
Consumer comfort with doing these activities, going to the movies, going to the gym, going to a concert, that dropped down roughly one third. And it hasn't budged since. It's been about 9 weeks of no movement.
That fits the experience of 26-year-old Jessica Montoya of Portland, Oregon. She was picking up a takeout breakfast this morning near the open-air fruit stand where she works. I asked how she feels about dining in.
Not entirely comfortable yet.
She's done it once since local COVID restrictions were lifted in June.
You wear your mask to go sit down, but it seems like after that you're just not wearing the mask, so in my head it somewhat defeats the purpose.
Morning Consult finds the number of consumers who feel comfortable dining out at restaurants has fallen 10 points since May to just 31%. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, so take all that reporting that Mitchell just did and come back with me to the land of how is this happening? Millions of people have lost their jobs. Small businesses are set to go under at a terrifying clip, and consumers, I mean, we just did that, right? And yet the housing market is kind of booming. The Case-Shiller National Home Price Index came out today, and it showed that existing home prices were up 4.3% in June compared to the same time last year. Last month, that is July, according to the Census Bureau, a frenzy in new home buying pushed prices up for them more than 7% from a year earlier. And yet, buying a house has actually become more affordable. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains what's going on here.
Home prices keep rising for one simple reason. There's still more demand than supply.
So that creates bidding wars, driving up prices.
That's Mark Fleming, chief economist at the title insurance company First American.
But at the same time, the 30-year fixed rate mortgage dropped below, this is heresy to say it, 3% in July.
He says that offsets higher prices by reducing monthly mortgage payments, making homes more affordable. First American's real house price index, which adjusts for income and interest rates, is down almost 5% from a year ago. That's nationally, though. Fleming says in cities hard hit by job losses, like New York, Pittsburgh, Orlando, and St. Louis, affordability has declined.
Because even with low rates, your incomes have gone down in recent months.
That could spread to more markets if the economy and unemployment get worse. There's also more to affordability than the monthly payments. Daryl Fairweather is chief economist with Redfin. She says when prices go up,
that creates a big barrier for down payments because you still have to put down 20% if you're going with a conventional loan.
To make homeownership truly affordable, she says we need more houses. Builders are making progress on that in spite of lockdowns and social distancing requirements, but she says it's going to take a long time to dig out of a hole that's been a decade in the making. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was a little up, a little down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. American Airlines said today it's going to lay off or furlough 19,000 people come October the 1st. Passenger loads and thus revenues are just a fraction of what they were before the pandemic. After the cuts, American's going to be 30% smaller than it was 6 months ago. And the same thing is happening elsewhere in global aviation. British Airways has decided to permanently lay off 10,000 people, about a quarter of its workforce. That's from cabin crew to office staff. And some of the 30,000 who are going to keep their jobs are going to have their pay cut in half. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
I'm in an open-top bus headed for Heathrow Airport along with half a dozen workers from British Airways. Not what you'd expect to hear from your friendly British Airways cabin crew, but they're venting their anger at their employer.
We are going to be on the lowest pay, the lowest terms and conditions. If British Airways get their way, and I say no way, BA, you're an absolute disgrace to treat people like this who have built the airline.
What BA has done is unforgivable.
The protesting staff wear face masks, and not just because of COVID-19. If they reveal their identities, they claim, BA will penalise them further.
They're threatening my job. My job's on the line. It's absolutely unacceptable.
This man says he's worked happily for BA for more than 30 years, but will suffer a catastrophic hit if the proposed new terms and conditions come into effect.
Financially, it just means a huge drop in my salary. I've got a young family and a wife to support. It means my house might be on the line, might have to sell my house and move. The car will have to go. So it's a financial burden and stress on myself at the moment.
Under BA's restructuring plan, the lowest paid 40% of staff will get a small raise, but the rest face a cut of at least 20%. Some long-serving workers could lose half their current pay, and more than 10,000 jobs will go altogether, the whole package incurring the wrath of one of Britain's biggest labour unions.
It's brutal. It's without any empathy for individuals. It's completely without respect for the levels of service that our members have given to British Airways.
Howard Beckett of the British Union Unite. He says throughout the pandemic, the taxpayer-funded furlough or job retention programme has paid the wages of much of BA's workforce. The job cuts, he says, are a betrayal.
That's not what the taxpayer understood the job retention scheme to be about, and it's certainly not what it was intended to be about. The clue is in the title. It is intended to be a job retention scheme.
But BA says the criticism flies in the face of reality. Since the start of the pandemic, the airline has flown at barely 5% of its normal capacity. In a statement to Marketplace, the company said its latest financial results clearly showed the impact of the crisis. The carrier has lost more than $1 billion and is currently losing $26 million a day. Willie Walsh, the boss of BA's parent company, told the BBC that BA must adapt to survive.
I think this is by far the biggest crisis we have ever faced and clearly requires us to take very quick and deep action, not just to survive this, but to ensure that we're in a position to be competitive going forward.
BA's profits depend heavily on its international routes, especially across the Atlantic, and on business class passengers. Travel restrictions on both sides of the pond and the recent growth of video conferencing have hit revenues hard. BA's drastic action is justified, says aviation consultant John Strickland.
I think the airline is looking into the abyss and it realises it has no choice but to take radical actions now, not just to lay people off temporarily or cut capacity temporarily, but it needs to make structural changes and improve its efficiency for the foreseeable future.
BA! BA!
BA's aggrieved workers are deeply upset at the permanent layoffs and the lower pay that's been proposed. The Unite Union is threatening industrial action, and this could become a nationwide issue. When the taxpayer-funded furlough programme ends in the fall, tens of thousands of jobs in other industries seem set to disappear. A new era of labour unrest in Britain could be dawning. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Every week, more schools around the country are reopening, or not reopening, as the case may be. There are state-level guidelines in a lot of places, but a whole big part of what K through 12 is going to look like this semester is being decided at the local level. Scott Anzalone is a family physician. He's also the local school board president where he lives, and he is one of the 10 people we have been following for our series, The United States of Work. Here's a real quick dispatch he sent us about the first week of school in the Logan Hocking School District in southeastern Ohio.
It's been an ongoing discussion since March. How are we going to do this? You know, are we going to have school? Are we going to go back full time? Are we going to go back virtually? So every school district around is basically doing something different in our area. But our county being more rural and having low internet access, we have about 30% of our kids who don't have adequate internet access. So we knew that, you know, a virtual education is not going to be, you know, adequate to reach our entire district. So we gathered multiple teams in our district, which included teachers, custodians, cooks, bus drivers, basically all facets of our faculty. And we came up with our plans of return. And that consisted of about a 32-page document. And we have basically have a plan A, which is going back full-time, plan B being split. And then we also have a virtual academy. We're making, you know, every possible precaution we can. We've closed down all the water fountains. We're replacing them with water filling stations. We're not using our lockers. Kids are going to be carrying their own bags. And it's definitely been a lot of work and planning. That's been the biggest difference. It's just, you know, normally it's time to start school. We're, you know, we have a well-oiled machine. This time there was a big, you know, wrench in the system. So, you know, God willing, it'll all work and we'll be fine and safe. And if we start seeing numbers climb and when there's, you know, safety issues, then we'll go to plan B.
Dr. Scott Anzalone there in Logan, Ohio, the president of the local school district, also one of the 10 people from our series, The United States of Work. Coming up.
I'm first and foremost an entrepreneur. That was pretty obvious to me at age 8 when I made my first sale at a grocery store.
Sometimes you just know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 60 today, 0.2%, 28,248. The NASDAQ up 86 points, about 0.7%, 11,466. The S&P 500 added 12 points, 0.3%, 34.43. American Airlines, I mentioned. A glimpse now, though, at some numbers from a new report by the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. To help paint a picture, carriers reported 192,000 scheduled domestic flights in the month of May 2020. That compares to more than 331,000 in the same month the year before. And of those scheduled flights, by the way, more than 12,000 were canceled. Bureau reported in late July the average domestic airfare down to $336, the lowest inflation-adjusted average on record. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is, as regular listeners to this program know, made up of just 30 companies, which means, given the Dow's profile, that which companies are in that 30 and which aren't can have an outsized impact. And that gets us to this. S&P Dow Jones indices, the people in charge of who's in and who's out, have announced some changes. Pfizer, Raytheon, and ExxonMobil are out. Honeywell, Amgen, and Salesforce are in. And it has escaped exactly nobody's notice that in Salesforce, the keepers of the Dow have added a giant technology company to their number. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains.
Late last month, the Dow had a problem on its hands. Its most valuable company, Apple, announced plans for a stock split. That meant more Apple shares and cheaper prices.
This is not an ideal situation that we were looking at.
Howard Silverblatt is senior index analyst for S&P Dow Jones Indices. Not ideal, he says, because a cheaper Apple share price would lower the tech sector's overall slice of the Dow. That, he says, just wouldn't have reflected how important tech is in the American economy.
The intent here is to emulate the market.
Silverblatt says Salesforce will help boost tech's profile in the Dow, though tech companies make up a larger portion of the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. Evan Rawley at the University of Minnesota says the Dow's decision will help the index stay relevant.
If their index is perceived as being a valid reflection of the U.S. economy, then it will get more press and more attention, and it will help the brand name of the Dow Jones Company.
Tech companies have been grabbing a bigger share of the U.S. economy for the past two decades, says Nathan Tuft at Manulife Asset Management. He says tech will likely become even more important to the overall market with the growth of cloud computing and 5G technology.
There's a lot of trends that are really favorable for tech stocks that have been in play and will likely continue to be in play for the foreseeable future.
And he says COVID-19 has made tech an even bigger part of people's lives. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Well, let's see now. We've got wildfires in Colorado and California, record-setting wildfires, I had to say. We've got a tropical storm hurricane 1-2 punch hitting the Gulf Coast. Surely meteorologists will tell us at some point later this year that this was the hottest summer on record in this country, as they have been saying regularly for the past however long it has been. The climate is changing. Glaciers are melting. Sea levels are rising. And in addition to being globally existential, oh, it's an economic story, too. Marketplace's Sabri Benishor has it.
Greenland's ice sheet melted more last year than it has since at least the 40s.
So it lost enough water that it would cover all of California in 4 feet of water.
Alex Gardner is a research scientist at the National Jet Propulsion Laboratory and co-author of the study detailing the ice loss in the journal Communications, Earth, and Environment. Sea levels are overall rising slowly but steadily, on average a little more than an eighth of an inch per year, he says. It's a small amount that adds up.
You know, next time you have a storm come through, that maximum storm surge will now be, you know, about a meter higher at the end of the century. And that's really impactful for coastal communities.
Sea level rise set a new record for the eighth straight year in 2019. New flood models developed by nonprofit First Street Foundation quantify current and future flood risk to U.S. properties from rising sea level and increased precipitation. Matthew Eby is executive director.
There's about 14.6 million properties that have substantial flood risk, so a 1% annual risk of flooding or greater.
That's about 10% of properties and 6 million more properties than FEMA estimates, which don't factor in climate change-related increases in precipitation.
You have another 1.6 million homes across the country that fall into that category by 2050.
Last year had a record number of extreme warm days globally. Jessica Blunden is a climate scientist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
In 2020, where we are now, we're on track to be near record warm again this year. We track this. Our records go back to the 1800s. And this is just, it's unprecedented and it's not going to slow down.
It most likely will slow down economic growth. The last national climate assessment in 2018 predicted unmitigated climate change could shave more than 10% off a U.S. annual GDP by the end of the century. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
We have come to that time of year when the big bins of watermelons in the grocery store are starting to be replaced by the big bins of pumpkins. Especially if you're in a grocery store in the Midwest, the odds are real good that at least some of those melons and a whole lot of those pumpkins were grown at Fry Farms in southern Illinois. When she was basically still a kid, Sarah Fry started a produce delivery business and in the process saved the then distressed family farm from foreclosure. Today, she lives on that same farm and, as it happens, sells more pumpkins than any other farm in the United States. She's got a new memoir out about all of it called The Growing Season. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai. Thanks for having me.
I don't want to spoil the book, and I recommend people read it because it's a good, nice read. But you had, it is safe to say, an unconventional upbringing on that farm, and you saw early on that you sort of had to do stuff for yourself. And so the question that comes out of this is, are you a farmer or are you an entrepreneur?
I think I'm first and foremost an entrepreneur. That was probably pretty obvious to me at age 8 when I made my first sale at a grocery store. I did have an unconventional upbringing growing up, and you know, really what was rural poverty in a part of the country mm-hmm. that has been, you know, forgotten. And, you know, I grew up doing things as a young child that most adults wouldn't venture to do. And I think that's true for a lot of farm kids. But in my case, it was a very difficult upbringing. But I will say that all of those things and all of those experiences have formed me in my adult life and helped me accomplish what I needed to overcome.
We'll get to the accomplishments in a second because they are substantial. But back up for a minute. That piece of the country that's forgotten thing. Tell me about that and tell me why you said it.
So, I mean, I grew up in rural America, and as a child, I dreamed of leaving this place because generally there's a lost sense of hope, especially in these communities where opportunity doesn't seem to be present. And I spent my entire childhood and most of my teenage years planning and plotting my escape out of rural poverty.
So the opportunities that you have had, as we've established, you have largely created for yourself. For me, the pivotal one was as you're trying to establish your farm and your business, you see a Walmart distribution center being built, and you basically walk in and say, hey, I'm Sarah, you need to buy my stuff, right?
Well, it wasn't quite as simple as that, but pretty close, actually. At the time, I was about, I don't know, 19 years old. I was driving by with my, you know, with my truckload of melons delivering to their stores. And I thought, gee, if I could just pull in there and give them all of these melons, I could haul so many more. It would save me time if they could distribute them. So, and that's exactly what I did. I pulled in, I walked in the door, and as fate would have it, they had buying offices that they were building, and they had a produce buyer there. And I walked out of that meeting thinking to myself, now, wait a minute, she said she wanted 3 semi-loads of cantaloupes a week. And this trigger went off in my head that she's talking about semis. And I literally had a Ford, like, one-ton diesel dually sitting in their parking lot that I had been hauling the melons with. So, you know, but I just said yes. And I said, you know, I'll do it. And there was never, I didn't hesitate for a moment because I knew I would figure it out at whatever cost.
That gets me to the subtitle of this book, right? It's called The Growing Season, How I Built a New Life and Saved an American Farm. I don't want to get all psychoanalytical here, but I wonder whether the farm saved you.
No, I was on my way.
Huh.
I knew that I was destined to go do something outside of this community. What I didn't know is that there would be a moment, and literally in a matter of seconds, split seconds, when I would make a decision to stay.
What was the moment?
You know, the moment came when, so the farm had been financially distressed for most of my life growing up. And there was a moment when I was walking the last horse off of the farm. I had to sort of sell off the few assets that were here. And I looked at this horse, and the horse looked back at me. And I was a kid. I was a teenage girl. And I was ready, you know, with all of these dreams of leaving. But in that moment, I felt this really incredible desire to plant my feet firmly in the ground instead of flying away. It was almost a spiritual moment for me.
Sarah Fry of Fry Farms, also now a book. It's called The Growing Season. Sarah, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai. I appreciate you.
We've got an excerpt from Sarah's book about mixing her rural roots with that CEO life she now leads at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which it seems Dunkin' Donuts has become my nemesis. We did the whole mid-August debut of Dunkin's Pumpkin Spice Latte a week or two ago. Don't get me started on Starbucks today, I know. So there's that. Anyway, now comes news that Dunkin', in partnership with Harpoon Brewery, has developed a line of donut-inspired beers brewed with actual donuts. There's a Boston Cream, that's cream with a K, stout. also a jelly donut IPA. Said Harpoon's CEO, and this is a quote, "Our brewers have always been master innovators, but brewing beer made with real donuts was a first even for them." Yeah, I bet. I bet. Okay, we got to go, but first a super quick moment of economic context this Tuesday. You remember that extra 0.5% adverse market fee that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were going to impose on home mortgage refinancing starting September the 1st? Yeah, belay that. In the face of almost universal, you are going to do what now? Opposition. The company said today they're going to delay that till 1 December, but still, luck in your aid as soon as you can on those refis, right? That's the smart thing. Digital and on-demand around here is Afuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Beth Perlman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitar Nieves is in charge of all that stuff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.